Please give your attention to the text in Mark chapter 12, verse 13.
Then they sent to him some of the Pharisees and the Herodians to catch him in his words. When they had come, they said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are true and care about no one, for you do not regard the person of men, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay?" But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said to them, "Why do you test me? Bring me a denarius that I may see it." So they brought it. And he said to them, "Whose image and inscription is this?" They said to him, "Caesar's." And Jesus answered and said to them, "Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's." And they marveled at him.
Then some Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him, and they asked him, saying, "Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies and leaves his wife behind and leaves no children, his brother should take his wife and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers. The first took a wife, and dying, he left no offspring. And the second took her, and he died, nor did he leave any offspring. And the third likewise. So the seven had her and left no offspring. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, when they rise, whose wife will she be? For all seven had her as a wife." Jesus answered and said to them, "Are you not therefore mistaken because you do not know the scriptures nor the power of God? For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. But concerning the dead that they rise, have you not read in the book of Moses in the burning bush passage how God spoke to him, saying, 'I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. You are therefore greatly mistaken.'" May God bless the preaching of his word.
Thank you both. Good morning, church. As many of you know, my name is Stephen, one of the pastors here. Pastor Curtis is traveling this weekend, and so he should be back soon, but that's why I'm here and not him, for better or for worse. I've talked with some people this week. They said, "What are you preaching on?" And the best way to summarize it for some people is I said, taxes and the resurrection. So any other random topics you have for me, just approach me afterward. I'll be happy to address those as well. But these couple of passages that we're talking about today do have a significant place in the story of Mark. And I hope to flesh that out. I hope you see the big picture that is the big message being communicated through this passage. And I titled the sermon, "Surrounded, Jesus versus the religious and political leaders." Some of you, that will have rung a bell. There is a popular YouTube series titled "Surrounded," and what the concept of each video is it has one person with a particular viewpoint or leaning. They are in the center of this video, and then they are surrounded by chairs of 25 to 20 people. And these videos are about 2 hours long, and the goal of the people around this person is to refute the person, demonstrate why their arguments are deficient, and basically to win the debate. That's the goal. And there's been several videos. I'll just lead some of the most popular titles. One conservative versus 25 liberals, just as examples. One liberal teenager versus 25 Trump supporters. One atheist versus 25 Christians. Jordan Peterson versus 20 atheists. They have some popular names that participate in this. Probably their most popular video on this was with Charlie Kirk when he was surrounded by people. But this is just the idea of the video. They're surrounded by a bunch of people who disagree with them, and they each take turns teeing off on the person in the middle. And that's a similar circumstance that we find ourselves in today in Mark chapter 12, because Jesus is teaching in the temple. And surrounding Jesus are the religious and the political leaders of that day. And last week, right, we saw Jesus talking to the scribes, the chief priests, the elders, and he told a parable that upset them. And now some more religious groups who also have political power, the Pharisees, the Herodians, and the Sadducees, are coming together to try to discredit Jesus. That's what's taking place here. And the big idea is this. So far in the Gospel of Mark, we have seen Jesus demonstrate that he's the Messiah in several ways. One, through his power. We've seen him heal people, cast out demons. He's done miraculous acts. We've also seen pointers to his messiahship based upon his teaching. The people who have heard Jesus teach have been stunned and said, what authority? They marvel at the authority that he has when he teaches, because he doesn't teach like the rest of the religious leaders. And what's happening here in Mark chapter 12, the pointer that Jesus is the Messiah is his wisdom. And particularly how his wisdom triumphs over the elite intellectuals of that day and in that region as they attempt to stump him and discredit him. Yet Jesus prevails. And if Jesus is prevailing over the best intellectual minds of that day, then what does this suggest about who this man is? It's just another support for Jesus being who he really claims to be. 2 points, well, 3 points, actually. Here's the first point, if you're taking notes. Testing concerning taxes. Testing concerning taxes. Now, right before this, Jesus tells a parable against the scribes, the chief priests, and the elders, and it angers them because they perceived it was against them. So look at verse 12. Just back up one verse. Look at verse 12. Let's read it. And they, those religious leaders, sought to lay hands on him, but feared the multitude, for they knew he had spoken the parable against them. So they left him and went away. They want to get a hold of Jesus, but the primary barrier that stands in the way between them and getting Jesus is the people, because the people, at least here, are pro-Jesus. They're fascinated by him. And if the scribes come in and arrest him, they fear how the people will retaliate to them doing that. And so they can't touch him. They can't. But if they can discredit Jesus in front of the people and sway the people's opinion away from Jesus, and he loses favor in their eyes, then what's standing in the way of them doing whatever they wish to him? Nothing. So that becomes their plan. How do we steer Jesus, or steer the people away from Jesus? Look at verse 13. Then they, the scribes, sent to him. So they're sending people. You go talk with him, because he just made us look foolish. You go talk with him. Sent to him some of the Pharisees and the Herodians to catch him in his words. And this reveals just to what extent the religious people oppose Jesus, how much they feel threatened by him, because the Pharisees and the Herodians are enemies in and of themselves. It's a very awkward alliance going on between them. The Pharisees, they despise the Roman government, wanted nothing to do with them. Whereas the Herodians were in favor of the Roman government. They were all for it. Hence their name, after Herod, the Roman appointed authority. But here, these unlikely allies, they're willing to suspend their differences for the moment to come together for the greater cause of putting an end to Jesus. This kind of reminds me, I've seen this happen in different groups. The one that pops into my mind in our day is you have the feminists and you have the transgender community, and neither of them like each other. Because from the feminist perspective, the transgender community is getting in the way of women's success and accomplishments because men are participating in women's sports and so on and so forth. So they don't like them. Whereas the transgender community is looking at the feminists and saying, you are suppressing who we really are deep down. Who are you to deprive us of our authenticity? But both of them are willing to join arms when the Christian in the room raises their hand and say, well, hold on, we might disagree, but we're not going to stand for this nonsense over here. So they gang up against the Bible and against its teachings. This is kind of what's happening here. Pharisees, Herodians, they fight, but when Jesus enters the room, they're now allies. And they share the same goal. Verse 14. When they had come, they said to him, teacher, and just listen to this. Remember, their goal is to trap him. They're not being genuine. Listen to this. Teacher, "We know that you are true and care about no one, for you do not regard the person of men, but teach the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Shall we pay or shall we not pay?" What are they doing? Well, they're flattering Jesus. Are these statements true of Jesus? Yes, they are. He will speak the truth. He will not conform. He's not afraid of people's opinions. It doesn't matter about the status that they have. Jesus is a man of truth. And so they're trying to flatter him to keep embracing this mold, hoping that if they put a lot of pressure on him to speak the truth, that he'll speak recklessly. And then when he speaks recklessly, the people will hear him and become disinterested in him if he says something very risky or controversial. That's their plan. And their question is, hey, should we pay taxes to Caesar or not? Here's the trap. Here's the dilemma. If Jesus says yes, you should pay taxes, he will lose the favor of the people because the majority of the people despise the Roman authority. And they view the taxes as oppressive. So if Jesus says yes, he loses the people. Who gets to arrest him? The scribes. On the other hand, if he says no, do you think the Roman authorities are going to take too kindly to that? How would Roman officers respond when they hear that there is one among them who is encouraging people to defy the king and to withhold their taxes? He could be labeled as a seditionist. He could be charged with rebellion against Rome. He could be accused of inciting a revolt. Revolts have happened back then over these taxes. And then what would happen to him? Well, he'd be arrested by the Romans. So if you say yes, what happens? You're arrested. If you say no, what happens? You're arrested. These are the kinds of questions that make politicians sweat. It's a lose-lose scenario. So in the Pharisees' minds, they're just thinking, hey guys, let's just grab our popcorn. Let's sit back and let's watch Jesus try to figure this one out. Good luck clawing yourself out of this one. Now Jesus' answer is brilliant. And we also have to remember, Jesus is going to give truth, but he knows that these people aren't asking a genuine question. They don't really want to know. They just want to be able to hurt him. So let's keep reading here. How does Jesus respond? "But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said to them, 'Why do you test me? Bring me a denarius that I may see it.' So they brought it. And he said to them, 'Whose image and inscription is this?' They said to him, 'Caesar's.' And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's.' And they marveled at him." If you look at the screen here, we have a picture of what this coin would look like. And Jesus' answer is brilliant in several layers. Here's one thing you need to know. The coin of that day, the Roman coin, would have borne the image of Tiberius Caesar, who ruled during Jesus' day. And you see the text around the coin that's just a Greek abbreviation that would have said this: Tiberius Caesar, son of the divine Augustus. What does that mean? Well, that means when Jesus says, "Bring me one. I don't have one, bring me one." They then bring him one. They're in the temple, and they give him something that's technically an image of someone claiming divinity, and they have it within the temple. That's their first mistake, because now they kind of look foolish. You're not supposed to carry that type of stuff into the temple. They had money changers. You change that money out and get the money that the Jews would use. You don't carry images of false gods into the temple, and this is what they've done. Whoops. Secondly, the fact that they are in possession of a Roman coin means that they're utilizing and they're benefiting from the Roman currency. So Jesus' point is, hey guys, clearly you're using these coins because you have them in your pocket, and clearly you don't have a problem bringing this little idolatrous token into the temple. So what's the big deal about taxes? Why is that a big deal? Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. So importantly here, significantly, Jesus, in his answer, does not believe that paying taxes to Caesar is incompatible with being faithful to God. He doesn't believe that. He's recognizing that God has established lesser authorities in this world, like our government. And just because we're subject to a lesser earthly authority does not mean that we're just automatically rebelling against God and his authority. Think about it. We were all born subjected to the authority of our parents. Now, would we say back then, well, I was disobeying God because I had to obey my parents? We'd say, no, I was obeying God by obeying my parents. This is what Jesus is trying to help them understand. There is a rightful duty that we have to the authorities that God has given us in our life, including the government. And if they're not asking us to sin against God's authority, then, which includes paying taxes, then we should obey them. I've heard this reasoning before. I think I understand it. I understand the temptation. Why should I pay taxes knowing all of, or why should I have so much integrity when it comes to filing my taxes when I know the shady stuff that the government is doing with that tax money? Sure, that's legitimate. But at the same time, consider this. Don't you think the guy who's claiming to be son of the divine, Tiberius Caesar, would also use the tax money for shady, unholy things? Yes. Yes, he would. So, and Jesus still calls them to obey and pay the tax. We're not responsible for the outcome of that money. We're just responsible to be faithful. And if they use it in wicked ways, then may the blood be on their hands, not on your hands. Not on your hands. Also, when it comes to Jesus' answer here, I think he is saying you should pay taxes. You should be in submission to your government. But he answers in such a way that you can't really pin him down as to see what he said. If you're a Herodian who supports Caesar, you could hear Jesus say this and say, yes, exactly. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's. We're about that. But if you're a Pharisee, and maybe some of you in there, you've already had this thought, you're very logical. But if you're a Pharisee or someone who hated taxes, you could say, well, Jesus said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. That settles it. Everything belongs to God. So I shouldn't pay taxes. I should reserve this all for God alone. And Luke's gospel makes it clear, pretty clear, that this is how some of the interpreters, listeners, would have interpreted Jesus' words. Look at this, Luke 23, verse 2. And they began to accuse him, saying, we found this fellow, Jesus, perverting the nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is a king, is Christ, a king. So the brilliance of Jesus' answer here is that both parties, the Pharisees and the Herodians, could listen to Jesus' words and be nodding their heads and say, yeah. And then look at each other and be like, why are you nodding your head? That doesn't make sense. And this is why they marvel. This guy dug his way out of this. Not by lying, but by being truthful, by making them look like fools, and by being brilliant in his answer. How did this guy, this is the last outcome we expected. How is it now we ask this question, it seems like it's a lose-lose. Now we're the ones that look like fools. How did he do this? And these people, they have seen Jesus, and they've heard of Jesus' healings, exorcisms. None of that has made them marvel at Jesus. But when Jesus beats them at their own intellectual game, that leads them to marvel. And my guess is they haven't lost too many debates. But they do to Jesus. I mean, what else would we expect from the Messiah? Now, you might be thinking as we talk through this, what does it matter anyway if Jesus doesn't get the people to turn against him in this moment? He plans to get arrested and killed by the Jews and the Romans anyway, which is true, sure. But Jesus' hour has not yet come. And here's what you need to understand. The Gospel of Mark's making this clear. Jesus will not die because he was overcome by the wit of men. He will get arrested and he will die on his own terms. He will give himself up to the Jews. He will go to the Garden of Gethsemane at night, make himself vulnerable to a shady arrest. Then later on trial, when they arrest him, they're trying to bring up all this evidence. It's conflicting. They can't pin Jesus down. And so Jesus gives them exactly what they need because they couldn't do it himself. Jesus will not lose his life because he was overpowered or outsmarted. He will lose his life because he's laying it down on his own accord. And so when Jesus is at the cross, please understand this. It is not because Jesus misstepped or because he was tricked or deceived or forced. No man, no person, no group forced him to be there. Jesus didn't accidentally die for you. He put himself there and he subjected himself to such foul treatment and he bore the sins of the world, taking the wrath of God in our place, intentionally, willingly, so that our sins might be paid for, so that we could be justified, so that we could be declared righteous, so that our guilt might be wiped away, and we would turn to him for forgiveness. And while these religious leaders are occupied trying to conquer and put Jesus to death, Jesus is occupied with trying to conquer and put to death their sin, because that's what separates them from God, and they're just not understanding this. And I just wonder, how many of you need to hear this morning that Jesus, according to plan, went to die so that you would not have to die the death that is plagued by the wrath of God for eternity, so that you could be saved, so that you could be forgiven. Even if you're kicking against him, he still goes to the cross for people like that. Let's move to our next point here, testing concerning the resurrection. Testing concerning the resurrection. Pharisees, Herodians failed. Look at verse 18. Then some Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him, and they asked him. Now, pause really quickly. We don't hear as much about the Sadducees in the Bible, but what you need to know is they were the most powerful party between these three parties. They held the most seats in the Sanhedrin. The chief priest was a Sadducee. And so Jesus is encountering the party with the most power, the most leverage when it comes to the governing aspects of the Sanhedrin. And the Sadducees did not believe in a future resurrection of the dead or an afterlife because they only accepted the first five books of the Bible, Genesis through Deuteronomy. They rejected all of the rest. And so the resurrection was actually a hot-button topic between them and the Pharisees. And when they see that the Pharisees failed, they're eager for their chance to trip Jesus up, and they take their shot at him and question him about the resurrection to discredit him as well. Verse 18 again. Then some Sadducees who say there is no resurrection came to him, and they asked him, saying, "Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies and leaves his wife behind and leaves no children, his brother should take his wife and raise up offspring for his brother." Pause really quickly. I know that sounds weird, but that was a law in the Old Testament. If brothers were living together, and one brother had a wife, and the other brother was single, and this brother's wife died, and they did not have a son to receive the inheritance and to carry on the father's name, the brother was responsible to marry her, provide for her, and their firstborn son would continue the line of the deceased brother so that his name would not be blotted out in Israel and so that the possession could carry through. That was the law. And so now they're about to say, if that's true, imagine how crazy it gets if the resurrection is true. Let's look at this. Let's keep reading. Verse 20. Now there were seven brothers. The first took a wife, and dying he left no offspring. And a second took her, and he died, nor did he leave any offspring. And the third likewise. So the seven had her and left no offspring. Last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, in the resurrection, when they rise, whose wife will she be? For all seven had her as a wife. And so the scenario they paint is she's risen from the dead, gets to the afterlife, and she gets there. First thing she sees is all seven guys ready to claim her. And the question is, well, whose wife is she? And their point is, if the resurrection is true, doesn't this create all sort of marital chaos in the afterlife? I mean, what kind of absurd circumstances would the resurrection lead to if it were true? Therefore, the idea of a resurrection is ridiculous. This is their reasoning. And it was probably the same argument they stumped the Pharisees with. So let's look at Jesus in verse 24. Jesus answered and said to them, "Are you not therefore mistaken, because you do not know the scriptures nor the power of God? For when they rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven." Jesus' response, he's saying, well, first off, you don't understand the power of God. You do not understand the resurrection. When the dead rise, they receive new resurrected bodies. When that happens, they're not like we are now. They will be like angels, not angels, like angels, in the sense that there's no need for reproduction, no sort of sexual relationships, no exclusive relationships between people. Jesus is saying, your problem is not a problem, because in the end, she will be married to none of them. None of them. Now, some of you might think, that's a hard pill to swallow. So we consider marriage. When I get to heaven, the person who I've lived my whole life with, who I've journeyed with in marriage for so many years, will no longer be my spouse? I mean, besides Jesus, that's the person that I'm looking forward to seeing most in eternity. Will I not spend the most time with that person for eternity? Will we not live under the same roof? And my guess is that, I mean, not all, but many of us would long for that marriage covenant to continue into eternity, but it doesn't. When we said our vows, what did we say? We said, until death do us part. We're married until we leave this life, and that's it. And it's hard to imagine, if we're being honest, what life will be like not married to our earthly spouses. Does that mean our relationship will be less than it is today? Now, it's easy to err and kind of in speculating about life will be like then, but here's what we do know. In the afterlife, we'll be perfectly satisfied. And just because you will no longer be married does not mean that you'll feel as if there's something in the new heavens and the new earth that is missing or deficient. There will be no sorrow. There'll be no jealousy either. And my guess is because we will all be sinless and we'll be devoted to God perfectly like never before, that because of that, the least of the relationships in the kingdom of heaven are greater than the strongest, most vibrant relationships in this world, including our marriages. And so when my wife and I die, whoever goes first, and we go to heaven, though we won't be married, our relationship with each other will be stronger than it was ever before, including our relationship with everybody else. But the reality remains, she will not be my wife, and I will not be her husband. Hard pill to swallow. But this gives us a sober perspective on marriage. Our marriages are temporary, and we just need to let that sink in. So those of you who are married, just turn to your spouse. Don't look at me, I'm not your spouse. Turn to your spouse and say, this is it. This is it. Your marriage does not extend beyond this life. And because of that, shouldn't you want to make the most of it? We only have a limited time to enjoy this gift from God. Why spend that precious time being in conflict? Being angry, bitter, discontent, harboring unforgiveness. Why waste this time being unfaithful or allowing small issues that pale in comparison to your relationship as husband and wife to disrupt the love and joy that you ought to have in each other? Why be passive if this is it? Why be stubborn? Why keep insisting on our own way? Why prioritize being right at the cost of our marriage relationship? If it's temporary, shouldn't you want to make it count? My hope is that this would lead some of you to just look at each other in the eye and say, you know, this thing we've been fighting about, that, you know, it's the elephant in the room. This isn't worth it anymore. We can get through this. I don't want to let this drive a wedge between us any longer. I don't want to hold this against you any longer. I don't want to passively coast along in our marriage and just merely tolerate your presence in our home. I want to love you passionately. I want to fight for a God-honoring, Christ-exalting, pleasure-rich marriage, because we will not have this forever. This is what the sobering reality should drive us to think. And along these lines, the temporary gift of earthly marriage should also remind us that marriage is not the pinnacle of human existence. For those of you who have never been married, there is a loud message coming from our culture, and that message is this: finding love is the path to true happiness. That's it. And if you don't find love, you can do all these other things, but you'll be deprived in this life. And it's easy to think, if only I could get married, then my life would be better. Then my problems would go away. Then I can know joy. How common is it in movies? You see this all the time. The final climactic arc of the movie is these two people falling in love and getting married, and that's it. They don't show anything beyond that, because apparently, you know, dying, learning to die to self, having kids, getting old, struggling through financial issues, that stuff doesn't sell tickets, right? But this is the message of the world. You need love. That's the path towards true and lasting satisfaction. And I think that's part of the reason the LGBTQ community, their message is so impactful. Because if you believe that, I need marriage for fulfillment, then who are we to deny their right to love? This is why it's so powerful. If we do that, aren't we stripping away the greatest opportunity they have at fulfillment? And many people hear that and they say, well, yeah, that makes sense. Let's buy into that. We can't put them in a box and make them susceptible to being mentally and emotionally deficient their whole lives. They will never know what true joy is if we do that. But that's only powerful if we accept the message that marriage is necessary for fulfillment. It's not. Let's not put it on a pedestal that it doesn't belong on. And now listen, I do not mean to belittle marriage. It is sacred, it is holy, it is God-given, it is supposed to reflect the relationship between Christ and the church. No other human relationship has that high of a calling. There are wonderful benefits that God has designed marriage to bring, but marriage isn't everything. If marriage were necessary for you to be satisfied, God would have made sure to uphold and establish our earthly marriages for an eternity. But because he doesn't, because it's just temporary, it's not meant to satisfy the eternal cravings of the heart. It can never scratch that itch. And if we put that level of expectation on our marriage, then we will be disappointed. Many people have thought marriage was supposed to be the answer, but it wasn't. Now my marriage, I'm just miserable. And that's because it was never meant to bear the full weight of our longing for fulfillment. When I get into an elevator, I'm weird. Maybe I do this. Maybe I'm just a fearful person. My eyes go straight to the weight capacity sign. You know what I'm talking about? A little weight capacity sign. And then I look around at the people in the luggage, run a quick calculation in my head, and then I'm like, okay, I'll stay on this elevator. Okay? The elevator will operate just fine as long as it's moving within its weight capacity. But if the elevator exceeds that weight limit, it will be vulnerable to dysfunction or to catastrophe. And in the same way, our marriages have a weight limit. God has designed them to carry this much weight, no further. Don't load your heart's deepest needs for joy and approval and acceptance on top of your marriage or your spouse. That's unrealistic. And if you do, don't be surprised if it breaks underneath that weight because your spouse can't carry that and they were never made to carry that. In fact, no person could. If you're looking past your spouse saying they could do it, no, they couldn't. No, they couldn't. Only Jesus can carry that kind of weight. That's why our earthly marriages end and why our heavenly marriage as the bride of Christ continues for an eternity. Only Jesus can love you perfectly. Only Jesus can love you permanently. Only Jesus can never fail you, fully understand you, exercise full compassion, and satisfy the deepest longings of your heart. Don't hitch your ultimate joy to it. Let's be careful. It's only temporary. Let's keep going here. Let's keep reading. Jesus says, first, you're wrong about the nature of the resurrection and the power of God. Second, you're wrong about the scriptures. Look at verse 26. Concerning the dead that they rise, have you not read in the book of Moses, in the burning bush passage, how God spoke to him saying, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but the God of the living. You are therefore greatly mistaken. So Jesus, he's quoting from Exodus chapter 3, the burning bush scene. And pause for a second. There are far clearer texts on the resurrection in the Old Testament. Here's an example from Daniel 12:2. It says, "And many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt." Why didn't Jesus quote this text? Why is he quoting this other text? If you said, well, because the Sadducees only accepted the first five books of the Bible. Bingo. Jesus is interacting with the text they accept, not the text that they reject. That's why he goes here. And he quotes this, which Exodus 3, which is taking place far after the death of Abraham, the rest of the patriarchs. And he's saying this text suggests they're still alive. Now, it's a little bit tricky. So for the Bible student, put your thinking caps on, because the verb am, as in I am the God of Abraham, is implied. It's not in the Greek text of Mark 12, and it's also not there in the Hebrew text of Exodus 3, verse 6. Our English Bibles just supply the verb am. It's because it's implied. And I mention this because some people, they look at this, they say, well, Jesus is arguing based on the tense of the verb. I am the God, not I was the God. If you're saying I was the God of Abraham, that would imply he's dead. But if he says I am the God, that would imply he's living. But it's difficult to make an argument from the tense of a verb that's not there. It's not there. Instead, the argument seems to be this. It's tricky, but you can follow it. The argument seems to be that God sees himself in a continual relationship with the patriarchs based upon the everlasting nature of the covenant he made with them. Everlasting covenant implies a continued relationship. Think of the marriage covenant. It's temporary. It expires. But because God doesn't make a temporary covenant, he makes an everlasting covenant, then that would suggest that Abraham would be alive in order for God to maintain this relationship with him, and he's still bound to it even after the death of Abraham. This seems to be Jesus' argument. And God still identifies himself with Abraham. So taking all this together, the implication Jesus draws is that God viewed them very much alive after their earthly deaths. Therefore, he says, he's not the God of the dead, the God of the living. Now, I know for some of you, like, that argumentation is way over my head. And while I was in seminary, there were times where I found myself listening to discussions between students and professors. And I thought, I have no idea what in the world is going on right here. Here's what I do know. These guys are really smart. Hopefully I can figure that out one day. And if that's you, listen, that's the point. The technicality of the argument is kind of the point. Jesus is very, very smart. And he can argue with the Sadducees inside of their own worldview and prove himself to be true. Even if the argument's like really complicated. Well, Jesus is a master theologian who knows the Bible like the back of his hand. And this argument worked. I mean, look at verse 28. Then one of the scribes came, and having heard them reasoning together, perceived that he had answered them well. The scribe thought, that's a great answer. Jesus is doing a pretty good job. They're landing with approval. Point three, shorter point. But here's the big implication of this text. Human logic will not triumph over Jesus. It won't. We have the scribes. We have the elders. We have the chief priests. We have a group of Pharisees, Herodians, Sadducees, all ganging up on Jesus to outreason him. And Jesus doesn't fall in any way. He mops the floor with them. The most educated people in that context, they lose. And let's not make the same mistake as these leaders. Sometimes we can think that we have a legitimate case against God. Sometimes we go through suffering or tragedy, and we think, God, you're in the wrong here. I have a whole list of reasons why this shouldn't be the way it is, or how this is inconsistent with you, or inconsistent with your word. This doesn't make sense, and we think we have a case against him. But how did that work out for Job when Job thought he had a case against God? Sometimes we can justify our sinful behavior, right? If this didn't happen or this weren't true, then I wouldn't do this. God, if you just ran things right, I wouldn't have to do it. It's your fault. And we just have to pause in those moments. We have to ask, do we really think this reasoning is going to work against Jesus? How did it work for Adam in the garden? When God confronted him, he said, well, it was the woman you gave me, God. It's your fault. Did that work out for Adam? No. Some people think that when they stand before God, they're just going to let him have it. They think they'll have some wise word to say, some case against God, some accusation to bring up that God wasn't expecting. Perhaps you're just justifying unbelief. There's this, 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 that, this, this, this. I remember hearing a famous atheist. He got asked a question in an interview. He said, so the questioner says, so you show up to God, or you die, you stand before God, you realize he's real. What do you say? And he said, no hesitation. He says, not enough proof, God. Not enough proof. And do we think God's going to sit back and say, wow, you got me. You're right, there wasn't enough proof. I should have made the universe a little bit more amazing. Absolutely not. How will you debate the God of the ages? What will you have against him? Every logical argument, every case, every reason we might have that leads us to think we somehow will have the upper hand against Jesus will be laid bare and exposed as embarrassingly deficient. I mean, Jesus triumphed over the most educated people of his day. They weren't just throwing him a bunch of random people, just a bunch of commoners. And are we to think that we're somehow going to be different? Are you wrestling with God this morning? Are you debating him in your mind? Should I submit? Should I not? Why do this? What's the point? Look at what's happened. And you're reasoning with him and you're saying, I am not going to take this step because of these reasons right here. Do you think those reasons are going to win out and be legitimate at the end of the day when all is said and done? No. Absolutely not. And if we cling to those our whole life, the same embarrassment that these people faced will experience, not on an earthly local level, but as we watch the heavenly hosts laugh at us in this courtroom as we try to make our case and God wipes the floor with us with logic, knowledge that we've never seen. And I think also, believers, when we consider this, we should take great comfort. There are some who are strong and powerful, but they are outclassed here. They lose debates, but they can use their power to silence their opponents. But then it becomes clear to everyone, though they're powerful, they still have a chink in their armor because they cannot win here. They have to win by force. But when we consider God, he will win the battle. He won't just win by power, but he'll also win the battle of the mind. When it comes to the end, every person will realize God was true and right. And every knee will bow and every knee will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. He's the true Messiah. You can't beat him. You can't outwit him. Seek him while he may be found. And trust, believers, if you're confounded now and you are looked like fools now, in the end, God will vindicate every one of his people and show that he was true all along. May we trust him. May we trust him. I ask you to bow your heads. We're going to get ready to take the Lord's Supper. I would ask you, in light of the sermon, just to examine your hearts as you prepare to take this. Are you wrestling with God? Is there some sin standing in between you that you need to take to him, that you just need to submit to him? Are you struggling to trust that in his infinite wisdom and his infinite love for you, that he's asking you to do something ultimately that will harm you? Surely every good thing God calls us to do is for our good. Let's reflect on our Savior and examine our hearts.